Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, October 5th, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And I just want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. There's a lot of ways you can do so, and many of them are free. Probably the thing that I would want to push the most right now is going to Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or really wherever you download the show and rating and reviewing the show, because that really helps us in the rankings. I've recently moved over to a new hosting platform and transferred my entire RSS. And I don't know. I don't know if that changes things. I'm not really tech savvy in terms of RSS world, but why not? Let's boost it up a little bit. October ask. Also, you can pledge your support on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy. So let's see. This week's top patrons include, let's go by pledge, not by tier. Yeah, include Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. Thank you guys so freaking much. All right, let's talk about this week's show. So I had the opportunity to sit down with Ben Cohen. He is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He covers the NBA, and he's got a new book out. It's called The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks. So there's some good psychology, some good skepticism, and also some of that thing we call sport, which we don't often talk about on the show. This is a really fun one, guys. So without any further ado, here he is, Ben Cohen. Ben, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Kara.
I'm really excited to talk about your book that has been out for a while now, but I'm super pumped to... Actually, has it been out for a while now?
When did March, you get March 10th, the day before the pandemic. Exquisite timing.
Well, that just means that you got to do all of your book events in your pajamas, right?
That's right. I never had to put on a button-down shirt while promoting this book. So it was not perfect, but there were some silver linings.
So you are a sports reporter, actually, and I'm really excited to chat with you about things that sort of cross between sports and more, I don't know, like statistics, psychology, that kind of world. I will say, right now, just so that you know, in case you didn't already, I am not very aware of this thing we call sport. It is not really in my wheelhouse.
Well, so that makes two of us, so that's perfect.
Good. There may be some references here that I need a little more background on, but I also love that you don't focus on sports in this book. You focus on streaks, and streaks are... we think, at least, ever-present in all sorts of different fields. Of course, sports is a place where I think people like to explain them. They try to make sense of them. And of course, they try to bet on them and then make money off of them. But ultimately, we do see this phenomenon or this pseudo-phenomenon in a lot of different places. So I guess the first thing I want to know is, how did a sports reporter decide to do a deep scientific dive into the idea of the hot hand?
Well, it's funny. I came to this project, this idea, and this book through my work writing about sports for the Wall Street Journal. And I've always sort of thought that writing about sports for the journal is this funny little enterprise, because the best stories that I write have to appeal to people who know everything about sports and also people who know nothing about sports. So I write about basketball, I cover the NBA. And, you know, ideally, my work will educate and enlighten and entertain people who watch, you know, every NBA game and can tell you everything that's happened about the NBA this season. And it can also do the same thing for my mom, who like doesn't know anything about the NBA. And that's kind of how I came to this phenomenon of the hot hand. This book really started with two stories that I wrote for the Wall Street Journal a few years ago. And usually what happens when I write a story for the journal, after I'm done thinking about that story and reporting the story and talking to people and writing and editing and publishing, by the time anyone else reads that story, I am so sick of it that I don't want to think about it anymore. The opposite happened with this one. I just could not get the hot hand out of my head. And there were lots of reasons why, and I'd love to chat about them. But I think generally it was because there was this really rich narrative saga behind this idea, this fight to understand something very intuitive. And, you know, fundamentally, this is a story about something that we all thought to be true, only to be told that it wasn't, only to realize that maybe it actually was. And maybe our intuition about streaks and momentum was not entirely wrong. And it's a story in which the main characters are NBA superstars and Nobel Prize winners, and it takes us in many different directions. And so that idea of using basketball to explore the world around us was something that was sort of irresistible to me.
I love this because I think that, you know, an everyday person might have heard the term hot hand and think, oh yeah, like a lot of people get hot hands and they have these streaks and then they're like, you know, I know they're going to do well because they've been doing well for so long. Myself, coming at it from a scientific skeptical point of view, right? Because I'm like hardcore skeptic, but also a training psychologist, I'm like, oh, hot hand. When I hear the words hot hand, I hear the word fallacy after them. And so I'm like, wait, isn't that a cognitive bias? Isn't this something that like doesn't exist? But it sounds to me like the research is a little bit more complicated than that.
Well, this whole field of literature about the hot hand started with this classic paper that was published in 1985. And it's really a study that is in the canon of behavioral economics. It was by three psychologists, Tom Gilovich, Bob Vallone, and the great Amos Tversky, who I think we all recognize as this genius who worked with Danny Kahneman and changed the way that people think about how we make decisions. And this paper that was published in 85 was about the hot hand in basketball, whether or not we should believe that it was real. And I guess I should pause here and say, like, what the hot hand is. And there's really no singular definition of it, but I kind of like to think of it as when success leads to more success. That's sort of the simplest way. In basketball, it's when you make one shot and then another shot and another shot, and you feel more likely to make your next shot. You feel like you're in the zone, right? You are on fire and you cannot miss. But the reason why these brilliant psychologists decided to study this idea, and the reason why psychologists and economists and mathematicians and statisticians have spent the last 35 years thinking about this idea, is that it's really not about basketball. It applies very widely. It's really how we make decisions and judgments and how our minds work. But what that first paper found, the reason it was so classic was this really highly counterintuitive conclusion, which is that there is no such thing as the hot hand. And I think that's what you're referring to, this fallacy, that it was simply a figment of our imagination. It was this really neat, digestible, accessible example of seeing patterns in randomness. And I think that's like the enduring lesson of that paper, regardless of the work that's come out since then. I think we do over-exaggerate patterns. And whatever we think of as the hot hand, this like really powerful, seductive force that we have all experienced, like that's the reason we all think the hot hand is real, because we have felt it and seen it for ourselves, or at least we thought we have. Right. The question is like how much we should trust what we see and feel, and like, what should we actually believe? And that was sort of the jumping off point for this entire book, like using that 85 paper and just trying to figure out what it really means, what we should think about it, and why it's so important, like how it applies to our everyday lives.
And it seems like, you know, when it comes to whether we're talking about the hot hand or the cold hand, right? Like a hot streak or a cold streak, because there is like an equal and opposite to this, which is that I'm like, man, things happen in threes, or man, why is it that every time when shit goes wrong, it starts, you know, pouring? It can't just rain, it has to pour. And it seems like there's probably a continuum of, I'd say, psychological traits here. So bear with me and then correct everything I'm about to say. So on the one hand, you have a clean example, like a laboratory setting example, almost like that taps into the gambler's fallacy. If you're flipping a coin and you're flipping a bunch of heads, you might be like, man, I'm on a hot streak. I know I'm going to flip more heads. And we know that that is a pure fallacy, that it's a total random chance what's going to happen next. And on the other side of it, there's the situation where your own sense of self-efficacy and accomplishment is boosting your performance to such a degree that you actually are doing better because you have a sense that you're going to do better because it's actually affecting your performance.
I think that is exactly right. And I don't really have anything to correct there. I mean, I think really the crucial distinction here is the one of control. And I think that's sort of what you are flicking at a little bit. Like when we feel that we have control of our situation, when we have agency, we think the hot hand is real. But interestingly, when we recognize that we're at the mercy of chance, when we are flipping a coin, when we walk into a casino and go to the roulette wheel, we kind of believe the opposite. We actually don't think the hot hand is real. And, you know, one of the chapters in this book is about the gambler's fallacy that you refer to. And I like to think of the hot hand. You walk into an NBA arena and you see someone like Steph Curry make three shots in a row. What everybody in that arena thinks is that he is going to make his fourth shot. That is the hot hand. But if you walk into that casino that we talked about and you go to the roulette wheel and you see the ball land on red three times in a row, what research actually shows is that most people bet on black the next time.
Right.
And that's so funny and interesting to me. Like you bet on the streak to end instead of continue. Three things happen. In basketball, we bet on the fourth thing to happen. And in gambling, in roulette, we think the other thing is going to happen. And like, that our minds can work that way is so funny and peculiar to me.
But it also makes, in a way, perfect sense, right? Like, if you start to really unpack it, you think, well, you know, Steph Curry has a lot of skill. He has a good day. He's, you know, really focused today. For whatever reason, I'm seeing that he's doing really, really well. And so I think he's going to continue. But in the casino setting, it's like, ugh, that's the gambler's fallacy, right? Man, they're really, like, pushing their luck now. They've hit three reds, and the odds are 50-50. They're bound to hit a black soon.
Totally.
And that's the real problem, because each time is not dependent on the last time. The new turn or the new, I don't know anything about roulette. You turn a wheel or something.
Yeah, you see the ball rolling around the wheel.
The
but
spin.
If you think about it, if you think about like what a casino floor looks like, the casino encourages you to believe in those numbers and to place your bets accordingly. So mm-hmm. you go to a roulette wheel and you see the last 20 numbers that the ball has landed on and you see the red-black split. Like those numbers mean nothing. They really have no influence over what is going to happen next. And yet Las Vegas wants you to believe they do. And it's the reason why so many of us leave Las Vegas, having made very charitable donations to the tourism board there, because like our minds are hardwired and programmed to search for these patterns. And I think one of the things that I've thought a lot about while writing this book and since publishing it is like, is your environment more of a casino or is it more of a basketball court? Like, are you at the mercy of chance or do you have some control over what you are doing? And I think it sort of differs based on like every environment. And that's one of the fun things about thinking about this idea is sort of fiddling with it and figuring out where you land on it for yourself.
So then I have a question for you, because, you know, when we talk about something like roulette or we talk about something like, you know, a standard floor game, we're talking about a game of chance, like a pure game of chance. And usually the odds are actually stacked in the house's favor. We know this. And so, you know, whether we're talking about a roll of the die in craps or a spin of the wheel in roulette, what's going to happen is really based on, you know, a larger statistical analysis. And every so often, somebody does well, but statistics tells us that that would happen. But in a game like poker, for example, which is more, I consider a game of skill. I don't even consider poker gambling because there is no house. You're playing against other people. You know, there is a certain amount of luck involved in poker. And, you know, the takeaway is to maximize your wins and minimize your losses. People still have that sense of the hot hand when they play poker. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's because I think poker, oddly enough, is a little bit more like basketball than it is roulette. I just read the Maria Konnikova book, The Biggest Bluff, who I think you just talked to, right? And, you know, she makes that point in the book that like poker is the only game in Las Vegas that you don't need the best cards to win. Like it's really about decision making. And basketball is sort of the same way. And I think that there are lots of environments that are like that. You know, when I think of roulette, though, there are other environments that are like that, that are it's kind of like depressing and crushing to think about those settings where you actually don't have control. One of them is like the courtroom. So there was this paper that came out a few years ago, this really brilliant paper by these economists at Yale who tried to look at the gambler's fallacy in real world situations. So not a laboratory setting, but finding data that could bear out whether or not decision makers with lots of authority invested in them, behave according to the gambler's fallacy. So they looked at loan officers and they looked at baseball umpires. But I thought most interestingly, they looked at judges and they looked at what people in an asylum court do and how they behaved. And what they found was really demoralizing and to me, dispiriting. They found that when an asylum judge has granted asylum to two or three refugees in a row, he is much less likely to grant asylum to the next case he sees, regardless of the merits of the case. The judge behaves according to the gambler's fallacy, and that makes a courtroom more like a casino than a basketball court. And so these are refugees who, like, you know, deserve and sort of demand our compassion maybe more than anybody on earth, and yet their lives are subject to the gambler's fallacy. And to me, those are the human consequences of these psychological phenomena. Like, it seems kind of trivial in baseball and basketball, but it's not when you are in a courtroom and your fate depends on how a judge has acted in two or three cases before you that have absolutely nothing to do with you.
And I can only imagine that that extends to so many different examples, because I'm sitting here trying to empathize and put myself in those shoes. And I know that feeling of like, have I been too restrictive for these past several decisions, or have I been too permissive for these past several decisions? Maybe I should be changing my strategy now, or maybe I need to reevaluate. And then it's kind of like the pendulum swings a little too far in the other direction for you to find equilibrium.
Of course.
There's this real psychological need to constantly try to reach homeostasis. And it's like we're all trying to always be fair. And when we reevaluate and we say, I haven't been fair, I haven't been equitable, maybe I need to overcorrect.
And think about how many of the decisions in our lives, seemingly random choices that are made by other people, can have so much power and influence over how our lives turn out. Like, if you write an essay to get into college, like, the admissions officer that day may have just read like the two or three best essays that he'll ever read. And because your essay comes next, it will pale in comparison to those, right? And so one of the economists in that, who wrote that paper, this guy named Toby Moskowitz at Yale, when he thought about the gambler's fallacy and how even experts, even people like judges who are trained to make like impartial, objective, unbiased decisions find themselves prone to this fallacy. He thought, well, how does this apply to my own life? And like, how can I make sure that I am not so prone to it and like reduce its effect on how I make decisions? And so what he used to do when he was grading papers, he's a professor at Yale, and of course he has papers to grade, is he would split them into and give them to his teaching assistants, and they would just sort of go through and they would just offer a grade, like just like anybody else would. But what he did after writing this paper and studying the gambler's fallacy was that he still splits them in two, but he has them graded twice by his teaching assistants, and he shuffles the order in which the teaching assistants see them. So no longer will a TA read like three A-plus papers in a row and then give a fourth paper a B-plus because it doesn't read quite as well as those three A-pluses. They see them in different orders now, and he thinks that doesn't quite solve all of the problems, but it does enough to reduce this bias that it's worth doing. It's not something that we can really do in an asylum court because there is such a remarkable backlog of people trying to come to the US right now that you can't hear their cases twice or like randomize the order in which they are heard. But there are examples like that where you can sort of take those lessons and apply them to your own life that I think are really interesting.
Right. I mean, it's why in not just psychological research, but all scholastic research, we aim to do things like have random sampling or matched controls is in an effort to reduce bias across the board. And one of the things that we often do with like psychometric testing is we change the order of the questions. You know, how are these questions presented? And does the same person who takes a test multiple different times answer differently based on the order that the questions are presented? Because the last question can affect the next question. I can only imagine one thing that came up for me when you were giving the example of the asylum court and then of the college admissions officer is, you know, it's not just sometimes, unfortunately, about skill and how skill is perceived relative to previous skill or post-skill. I think sometimes it's just about what we think of as normativity. And unfortunately, we live in a culture and a society that has deep racial and sexist entrenchment. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, we see white male cis, whatever, as being normative and everything else as being other. And I can only imagine that a lot of historical injustices have occurred when even the most well-meaning people say, okay, woman, ugh, I can't accept another woman. I'm on a woman streak here, you know, or like black dude. I got to change my game here. I can't believe I accepted four black dudes in a row, instead of looking at each individual as a random sample in and of themselves. They're constantly comparing them to what they see as regressing to the mean. And unfortunately, we women and people of color have often been seen as outliers, not normative.
That's right. And I actually write a little bit about a story along those lines in the book. I sort of tell the tale of this brilliant early 20th century composer named Rebecca Clark. And I think, you know, when we think of the hot hand, our conception is that if you do three things well in a row, if you have three hits, three successes in a row, you make it more likely that the fourth thing you do in whatever, if you're taking a basketball shot, or in the case of Rebecca Clark, if you happen to be composing symphonies, they will find an audience and people will be more receptive to them, in part because success begets success. It sort of makes it easier to create other hits. And there are countless examples of that. But in the case of Rebecca Clark, it was not quite true. And it was in part because she was a woman. And in the early 20th century, composing beautiful classical music was not something that women were thought to do. And so even after she had three hits, including some that were in blindly judged competitions, which is how you know that she was this sublime talent, because there couldn't be any prejudice against her because the judges in the competition were hearing her work blind and they were basically treating her like a man and giving her the benefit of the doubt. Even right. then, she recognized that she was not in an environment that rewarded the hot hand. And what she did was she stopped composing music for 50 years. And only when she was very old and very late in her life did she have this renaissance where people rediscovered her music, because once they could hear the music without attaching any sort of identity or, you know, personality or explanation to it, they heard it for what it was, which is this really beautiful, timeless, enduring music. And, you know, now her music is in circulation and she's had this like full-blown revival in a certain way. But we still don't really have much of her work because she was discouraged, right? And so I think that's a perfect example of that. But, you know, there are also, I should say this book isn't like entirely depressing and about people who, you know, never had the hot hand or, you know, were penalized for the hot hand. There are so many examples of people who used the hot hand to their advantage and leveraged it to like elevate their lives and their careers. So like the opposite of Rebecca Clark would be Rob Reiner, the movie director who, you know, you might remember like the first few movies that he made. The thing that Rob Reiner did like so spectacularly well was he made hit movies of movies that nobody wanted him to make. There were these delightful contradictions. So the first movie that he directs is This is Spinal Tap, right? Which becomes this cult classic. Nobody wanted him to make it. The next two movies that he does are Stand By Me and The Sure Thing. And all three movies, in some way, whether commercially or critically, are big successes. And they kind of give him the capital to do whatever he wants to do next. And he has this really hilarious and kind of memorable exchange with the studio executive around this time, where she says, "It feels like you're hot, right? Like you're coming off three hits in a row. We want to give you money. Like, we want to bankroll you. We'll throw money your way. When you're hot, of course, like, screenwriters want to work with you and actors want to work with you. And in this case, studios want to throw money at you." And so this studio executive says to Rob Reiner, "Whatever it is you want to do, like, we want to do. So tell us what you want to do." And he says, "I'm telling you, you're not going to want to do what I want to do." Yeah. And she says, "No, seriously, we will. Like, we sort of see what's going on. Like, just tell us, name your project." And he says, "No, really, I'm telling you, you're not going to want to do it." And finally, at the end of this Abbott and Costello routine they have going, she says, just name the movie. Tell us, what movie do you want to make?" And he says, "The movie I want to make is The Princess Bride." And she says, "Anything but The Princess Bride." The Princess Bride is crazy to sort of think about now, because it is this beloved cult classic. But for a very long time, it was like this riddle and mystery that was like almost cursed in Hollywood. It was the great white whale of Hollywood movies. Robert Redford,
it was like on everybody's shelf and nobody wanted to touch it.
And well, everybody wanted to touch it, but like they felt burned as soon as they did. Like, nobody could get this movie made. Robert Redford tried to direct it and star in it, and he couldn't get it made. Norman Jewison, Francois Truffaut, both of them tried to direct it. William Goldman, who obviously wrote the book and the screenplay, like to say that like whenever a studio executive got close to touching The Princess Bride to make it, they would like inevitably be fired that weekend. Like, it was that perilous. But Rob Reiner was hot, and he felt like he had license to do things that like he wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And he capitalized on all of that attention into making The Princess Bride, even when nobody else wanted him to make it. And I think we're all luckier for it. And he actually used that like hot hand period of his career to elevate it, because the next few movies that he rips off are When Harry Met Sally and Misery and A Few Good Men. I mean, it's really one of the great streaks in movie making history. And I think it's like very safe to say that in the same way that Rebecca Clark wasn't able to take advantage of her hot hand, Rob Reiner was. And like, we are still watching the movies he made in that period because of it.
And so this really speaks to the split, right, between what we often historically had a conception of as the hot hand fallacy and what maybe now people are referring to more as the hot hand phenomenon. So what are some of the maybe economic or psychological factors that feed into an example of when the hot hand seems to actually pan out?
Well, think about what happens if we think about it through the basketball court. And, mm-hmm. you know, I have to say, I am an NBA reporter, but it's also sort of intellectually dishonest of me to not talk about basketball, because of the hundreds of scholarly studies that have been published about the hot hand, the biggest ones have all been through the lens of basketball, including that first one. I mean, really, like, you know, one of the most famous papers that we have in the field of psychology was done through the lens of basketball. So so let's stay there for a second. When you are a basketball player and you've made a few shots in a row, the hot hand warps the behavior of everybody on the court. So if you're the right. shooter, you want you. To shoot
it's
again, right?
You. Yeah.
You have the license to take crazier shots, riskier shots, longer shots, shots that you wouldn't ordinarily get to take. Shots like The Princess Bride, right? Like, that is the Princess Bride is this heat check. That's what they're called in basketball, when you make a few shots and you throw up a crazy shot because you know that you have permission to take it. But it's not just you. Like, your teammates try to get you the ball. Your coach calls plays for you. The other team changes its defense and tries to get you to not shoot. The other coach calls a timeout to try to cool you off. Like, he's basically trying to drench you in cold water when you feel like you are hot. So you feel something has changed, right? Like, something in your brain chemistry certainly has changed. The momentum that you feel internally, the confidence that you have, the benefit and the effect of scoring is that it sort of makes it easier to score in some respects. And, you know, that's not just basketball, of course, that's movie making, right? Like, you have these resources that were not available to you otherwise. But so I think that is clearly like one of the main underlying like psychological explanations for what's happening here. But I also think there is some mystery to it still. Like, we don't really have experiments where people have, you know, had electrodes strapped to their brains, or like under, you know, there are no like fMRI studies of what happens to your brain when you get hot. What we do know is that humans for a very, very long time have been conditioned to look for the hot hand. This is something that was evolutionarily ingrained into us. Like, there have been studies of primitive humans. There have been studies of monkeys who also believe in the hot hand. This is like, this bias is something that that we have because there's an evolutionary explanation. Like, you know, in foraging, it was really useful. Our world is not as clumpy as it was then. Like, the basketball court is not like a forest where trees have fruit. But like, we still believe in that, and it's really hard for us to shake that. Like, you know, this concept of randomness, as you well know, like, paralyzes the human mind, and it's hard for us to wrap our minds around. And that's really one of the fun things of thinking about this idea.
Yeah, we are absolutely pattern-seeking creatures as it is, and we talk a lot in like skeptic circles about things like apophenia, about different examples where we actually find connections and things that are unrelated, or where we see like pareidolia, where we see faces and things where faces don't exist.
Well, there's this really funny story about seeing patterns where they don't exist, which is something that Spotify and Apple both had to deal with early in their company. So, the Spotify example, not too long ago, you know, Spotify was this startup, right, that was born in like a shabby apartment in Stockholm. Now we think of it as like this behemoth in the music space, right? Like, Spotify, if you think about like what the breakthrough of Spotify or like something like Apple Music was, it was kind of like a miracle machine, right? Like, it allowed you to play any song, like almost by any artist, anytime you wanted, like no matter where in the world you were. That's incredible when you think about it. And yet, early in Spotify's history, they kept getting this complaint from users. And it was the same complaint. It was that when they randomized their music, they felt that it wasn't actually random. This was called the shuffle button on Spotify. They felt that the shuffle function was broken. And
they're like, why am I always hearing the same thing?
Exactly. And not just the same things, but the same artists twice in a row. And they came up with conspiracy theories to explain this, right? Because that is also how our mind works. And they, you know, basically charged Spotify with trying to curry favor with record labels by playing the same songs and the same artists several times in a row.
But let me guess, they just had more songs by that artist already like in their list.
Not even that. Think about how randomness works. Randomness means that if you have a playlist of like 20 songs, you might hear the same song twice in a row, right? Like, you might hear the same artist twice in a row. But that's not how we want randomness to work. Like, when we create a playlist, we don't want to hear the same songs. And ideally, we don't want to hear the same artist back to back. And the funny thing about this, this dilemma, this problem that Spotify had, is that Apple had the exact same problem when it introduced the shuffle iPod. There's this incredible keynote speech that Steve Jobs gave when he was talking about this problem, where he like is essentially describing in almost the exact same language the dilemma that Spotify had just a few years earlier. And Steve Jobs, like, even he had to assuage Apple users that there were no conspiracies, there was nothing nefarious happening here. It's just how randomness worked. But what both of them did, they both had to solve this problem in the same way. They changed their algorithms. They tweaked the code. So if you create a Spotify playlist now, what it does is it distributes artists over the course of that playlist evenly. So if you have a playlist of 10 songs, or let's say 9 songs, 3 songs by 3 artists, what it will do is most likely you will hear different artists. No one wants to hear, like, you know, 3 Billy Joel songs in a row, right? Like, you want to hear Beyonce and you want to hear the Beatles. And they basically had to make their code less random to feel more random, to give us the sense of randomness that we want. And so it's this perfect example of how we see patterns where they don't exist, even when we know better, and even when we are told explicitly by the people who write the code that we are being crazy.
That's so amazing. And it's so, it's always so fascinating to me how data scientists do such a good job to not just understand the mathematics of the data, but also to understand the human and user experience, which has expectations, right? Which has these built-in psychological biases, and those things have to be fed in addition to the data being utilized in, I guess, the most fair and equitable way.
For sure. Like one of the Spotify product managers who worked on this effort to rewrite the algorithms to take in the vagaries of the human mind into account said that like the brain is this very powerful pattern-seeking machine. Or as Amos Tversky said many years earlier, like we see patterns where they don't exist and we invent causes to explain those patterns. So even after, you know, Amos Tversky was like, what everyone who knew him said was that he was the smartest person they'd ever met. Like he was very clearly, obviously a genius. In fact, he won a MacArthur Genius Grant. Like he was officially named a genius. And yet, when he wrote about the hot hand, he was an enormous basketball fan, like a true NBA nut. And what he has said is that he has had 1,000 arguments about the hot hand. He has won them all and he convinced nobody. Like that is how powerfully we believe in this idea.
I love that. You know, and it also reminds me of a question I wanted to ask earlier, which was, I now am seeking the pattern that many of the psychological studies and kind of neuroeconomic studies written about the hot hand, as you said, oversample basketball as a source for data collection. Why do you think that is? Is it simply because the game lends itself to studying this? Or do you think it's because a lot of the researchers just happen to be basketball fans?
Oh, that's funny. I think it's a little bit of both. I think that like secretly psychologists love any excuse they can to look at sports data. But I think less secretly, I think people who have played around with sports data recognize that it's about as good as they can do. Like a real world setting with really high stakes and players with essentially the same incentive, right? The thing about basketball now, the data in baseball will always be better than it is in basically every other sport because it's a discrete game and you can kind of quantify everything that happens in a baseball game and inside a baseball stadium. But
and they do, right?
And they do, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, baseball, I think people in basketball like to think that people in baseball are like 10 to 15 years ahead of them. Like there's a reason why the book Moneyball was written about a baseball team and not a basketball team or football team or soccer team. But something interesting and kind of amazing happened in basketball arenas about a decade ago now. There were these cameras that were added into the rafters of every NBA arena that track what is happening on the court below them 25 times a second. And it creates this remarkable data set that teams are really mining for their benefit now. So not too long ago in 1985, when that first paper about the hot hand was written, we really didn't know anything about basketball data. In fact, the reason why the Boston Celtics and the Philadelphia 76ers are the two teams that are mentioned in that 85 study was that the Sixers were the only team that bothered keeping track of shots and the order in which they were taken, like just pure play-by-play chronology. Like the data that we have now just simply was not available to researchers then in their nerdiest, wildest, wonkiest dreams. Like we have so much granular detail about every shot taken in every game in any given season. And what the researchers who have taken another look at the hot hand in recent years have been able to do is use that data, that better data, to their advantage and try to figure out whether it tells them things that it had never said before. And so one of the ways that they rediscovered the idea or rediscovered the hot hand was like, always, whether there was a small hot hand effect, it had always been disguised, like masked by people, the way that they behaved when they did have the hot hand. So like if you're Steph Curry, for example, and you've made a few shots in a row, you're going to take a harder shot that has less of a likelihood of going in. But we were never able to account for that shift in difficulty before, right? Once you were able to do that, they found that we actually weren't all that crazy to think that there is a hot hand. Like we take harder shots and sometimes, you know, they go in at greater rates. And so, you know, to answer your question, in they psychologists and economists like studying sports because, you know, I think they have fun watching sports games, but also because sports is this really convenient excuse to explore everything that's happening around us. It's like this neat microcosm of society. And of course, once they publish about sports, people actually bother reading, which is a nice perk.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing that I can really attest to having started the process of getting into my dissertation is that one of the most frustrating parts of doing experimental science is physically collecting the data. And when you have databases available to you where data has been painstakingly and really cleanly collected for you that then you can utilize and analyze, it takes a lot of the headache out of doing experimental psychology. So I can imagine that it's a gift to be able to access these databases of so much pure, clean information.
Yeah, you have to wrangle the data and you have to clean it up, because I think that the data that they were getting from these NBA arenas was pretty messy in its raw form. But of course, you'd rather have more data than you would less data, right? And so if the problem is simply cleaning it up and trying to find signal in the noise, well, it's better than having to like painstakingly create that data for yourself. In fact, in 1985, like Amos Tversky wanted to code every basketball game for like a single team in a season. He was a big Boston Celtics fan, and I'm sure he would have loved nothing more than to watch all 82 games or have a grad student code those games and try to figure out how people behave when they have the hot hand. But even he said, well, nobody has the time to do this. Like, it was such an exhaustive process that it was just unimaginable then. And now it's automated. Now, like 15 minutes after an NBA game is over, I can log onto my computer just like as a public basketball fan and just know more about what happened than, you know, someone who had spent the entire season 30 years ago hand coding every game. Like, there's this remarkable revolution happening in sports. And the reason why the games are changing and the way that strategies are unfolding are different is because we have this data that's telling us different things.
One thing that sticks out to me is that when we talk about the hot hand as a phenomenon, not as a fallacy, so examples in which our behavior actually contribute to either a hot streak or a cold streak measurably, one of the things that's implicit in there being a streak is that a streak has borders and boundaries. It has to end. And so how does that, I guess, fear or worry or even recognition that streaks are just that, they are streaks, contribute to a continuation or a reduction of a hot streak?
Well, and also, like, the timeline of these streaks differ on industry and environment. So, like, if you're a basketball player and you get hot in one game, well, one game is 48 minutes, right? If you're Rob Reiner and you get hot, like, that's 5 to 7 years of movie making. So, like, how do we think about that? And I think it's a great question. It's something that I've tried to think about in my own work now. Like, there have been very few occasions at work when I do feel hot, but there have been those times. And what I've tried to remind myself in those moments is that the one thing that we know for sure about the hot hand is that it ends. We cannot bottle this magical feeling forever. And so I try to really capitalize on those situations while I can. So sometimes that means just like staying up late and keep working. It's kind of miserable, but like, I just remind myself that like when this ends, like there will be a moment when I don't feel the way that I do, and it's probably coming pretty quickly, and I'm going to regret not taking advantage as much as I can in this moment.
And that's almost like comparing hot hand to like a flow state at that point, right? Like, you're in it, and so you don't want to disrupt whatever it is.
And I think like flow state is like a perfect way to describe what is happening on a basketball court when somebody gets hot. In fact, one of the basketball players I talked to is this old college basketball player named Ethan Rogge, who a few years ago like made the first 7 or 8 threes that he took in a game. It was like one of the more brilliant shooting exhibitions that anybody in basketball had ever seen. And I talked to him a few weeks afterwards, and the way that he described that unconscious state that he was in, like, he might as well have been writing a psychology textbook without actually realizing it. And I think that most basketball players feel the same way. In fact, I asked Steph Curry, like, have you ever met a basketball player who does not believe in the hot hand or in this flow state, like it feeling different when you are in the zone? And he looked at me like I had eight heads and he was like, no, of course not. Like everybody in the NBA believes this.
And that's then leads me to an important question, which is what are some of the like crazy ways psychologically that people, I guess, approach this pseudoscientifically? So like, let's say somebody is on a hot streak and measurably externally, we could really say, okay, they're in a flow state. Like there is something happening here. They're doing much better than they should do compared to norms in their group, and they're doing better than they do compared to their own averages for a consistent amount of time. So now people start to do weird shit, right? They like wear the same socks and they get all these weird like conspiratorial practices.
Right. And then it runs out.
Because of this. Yeah. So like, what are some examples that you've come across of like weird ways that people try to hold on to their hot streaks?
The weirdest thing that I actually came across while researching this book was something that somebody didn't do, as funny as that sounds. So the hottest game that Steph Curry ever had, the best game of his basketball life, if you had asked him like 2 minutes before the game started, are you going to play well tonight, let alone have, you know, the best game of your career, he would have told you that you were crazy, because that day had been just phenomenally awful in every respect for Steph Curry. The night before, they had played a game and his team had gotten into a fight. And actually, he was kind of the reason why they got into the fight. So they land at like 3 a.m. in New York. He wakes up, he learns that he has been fined $35,000 by the NBA for his role in this fight. So he is cranky, right? Like, yeah. But it turns out that like nobody has ever been so fortunate to lose so much money because of what happens that night. But before he has this game, he has to get to the arena. The Golden State Warriors are playing the New York Knicks in Madison Square Garden that night. They're staying in a downtown New York hotel. And Steph Curry, like most athletes, is really superstitious about what bus he takes from the team hotel to the arena. Steph Curry always takes the second bus for whatever reason. But that night, for circumstances that he doesn't remember, which is odd considering what was about to happen next, he misses the second bus and he has to take the third bus from the hotel to the arena. And when the third bus pulls out of the hotel, it gets pulled over by New York City cops on the way to Madison Square Garden. So not only is he cranky, not only is he poorer, not only is he late, but now he has to rush his warmups because he's like especially late. He's been pulled over by the police on the way to Madison Square Garden. So everything has gone wrong. And yet he goes out and he does something that night that like he had never done before in the NBA. And still, to this day, he has never done since. Steph Curry is like the most influential basketball player on the planet now. He won two MVP awards after this game. The Golden State Warriors have won three of the last five NBA championships. And yet, to this day, what he did in Madison Square Garden, he scored 54 points. It's the most points he's scored in his life. He made 11 of his 13 three-pointers. He like just felt like he couldn't miss. And so you would think, like now Steph Curry would like purposefully miss the second bus and pray to the basketball gods that cops would pull over the third bus on the way to the team arena, whenever the Warriors are playing a road game. And yet he doesn't. When I asked Steph Curry, is there any way for him to predict when he is going to be in the zone? What he said, I thought was really interesting. He said, I don't know when it's going to happen or where or why or how it's going to happen. But once it does happen, you have to embrace it. And I think that is the best way to think about it, even if you are not Steph Curry. Like you can never really tell when this is going to happen. You can kind of just put yourself in a position where you hope it might. And if it does, you have to sort of recognize it in that moment and then do everything you can to take advantage.
I love that. And I think in a way that really is the ethos of most really successful poker players, speaking back to Maria Konnikova and speaking back to, you know, and I personally kind of my basketball is poker, right? Like I love poker and that's where I'm seeing a lot of these patterns. It's you cannot control what cards you're going to catch, but what you can control is how to make the most money on a good hand and lose the least money on a bad hand. It's all you can do. And so it's like, you've got to recognize what you're dealt and then utilize it to its best kind of advantage. I guess what's interesting to me is the point that you made, which is that like most athletes or many athletes at least are like superstitious. And Steph Curry, even though he is superstitious, maybe was not focused so much on superstition that night or in the future. But how much do you think superstition actually plays into the hot hand phenomenon? How much do you think doing the things that they feel like they're supposed to do to play well or screw up to play poorly actually affect how much in the game they are?
Well, I don't know if it affects what happens when the ball leaves their hand, right? But it certainly affects everything that happens before then. Like, I really do think like it changes behavior inside the lines of a basketball court. And that's like a really powerful force on its own. Like, it's almost, not quite, but almost irrelevant what happens when the ball leaves Steph Curry's hand after he's made three shots in a row and he pulls up from 35 feet with a hand in his face, right? Like, just mm-hmm. the sheer audacity it takes for him to like elevate and take that shot, knowing that he probably shouldn't take that shot, is really interesting to me. Like, I think that is where superstition and confidence and momentum kick in, where like everybody on the court thinks that he should take that shot. Like, it doesn't seem rational, but it would seem irrational to everybody who has played basketball. Like, I think that personal experience really shapes the way that people think. Although, can I ask you, Kara, like, what do you have any recollections of like feeling hot or feeling really cold at the poker table? Like, do those memories stick with you for a long time?
I mean, definitely. I don't think they really stick with me because I tend not to get on tilt at the poker table. And so I don't think a lot of things, well, I just try to be chillaxed there, but I think the times when it happens to me are the times when I feel like I'm just not catching cards. So it's less about like losing a lot of money or making a lot of money. And it's more about playing in a, let's say, tournament where I'm just feeling like I'm getting blinded out because I'm just catching shitty cards that
so
I
you
can't
remember the bad
do
things.
Anything with. Yeah, I think I tend to remember the misses more than the hits, but I think that's also my skeptic training. We tend to, you know, it's like when it comes to confirmation bias, we always remember the hits and not the misses. And I'm constantly trying to seek out the things that break the pattern.
Are there other parts of your life where you remember the hits instead of the misses?
Yeah, I think for me personally, it happens with work. So because I work in TV, a lot of this stuff that I've done historically has, you know, my bread and butter, like where I actually make money is not in academia or in podcasting. It's sadly, it's when I book gigs on television. Like, I work as a science communicator on TV. And it's one of those frustrating things, but it's like the thing that everybody says in Hollywood, which is like, you get work when you're working. And so I'll find that I'll be working and then I'll have to turn down jobs. And it's so frustrating because you can't make them work together because you've got something in first position. So you're literally turning down money that just 6 months ago you were desperate for because you weren't working. You know what I mean? And so that I will start to feel like I'm finding patterns in the noise where I'm like, oh, why do I get three jobs at the same time instead of having them all spaced out over my life so I'm constantly able to pay my mortgage?
That's really funny. I mean, the other thing, of course, that everybody in Hollywood says is something that William Goldman wrote many years before The Princess Bride, which is that nobody knows anything. And that was something that I thought about a lot when I was writing this book.
I love that. You know, and one of the things that is really salient for your book, The Hot Hand, which came out, like you said, in March, which is really funny because a film came out, let me see when it hit box office, in August. I want to say it was a Netflix movie. Yeah, because I watched it on Netflix, called Uncut Gems. Did you have the opportunity to watch this movie?
I very much know about it. And I've been told that like I need to be in the right frame of mind to watch it.
You do,
and every time
bananas.
I like sit down at night, I'm just like, tonight's not the night.
Yeah, it's a really intense, really whatever. It's a crazy movie. And the whole time you're like, how is this even a movie? But the interesting thing is one of the main plots, and I won't give away all the subplots or any of the outcomes of it, no real spoilers, is that a basketball star, Kevin Garnett, comes to this jeweler and he's really interested in like a watch or something, but he sees this uncut opal that the jeweler's got his hands on. It's actually kind of ugly, but it's a massive carat and eventually it would have been cleaned up. And he borrows it or he wants to buy it. And when he has it with him, he starts playing really well. And everybody, and I love what they do well in the film, is that different people have different perspectives. Like, he's obviously superstitious and thinks the opal is making him play well, but Adam Sandler's character, who's the jeweler, is clearly like, he thinks this opal's making him play well, and I need to capitalize on this and charge him a lot of money for this opal.
Like, so he sees right through it. The hot hand, right?
Yeah, and it's just such a perfect example of a lot of the things that we've been talking about. Like, it encapsulates the hot hand, and encapsulates the psychology behind it, what is random, what's not random, and also superstition as a whole, and what a weird phenomenon superstition really is.
For sure. I have to say, the other really odd thing about the timing of this book is something that I just could never have planned and obviously never envisioned. But chapter two of the book, there are three stories in it. One is the story of Rebecca Clark. One is the story of Rob Reiner and the Princess Bride. And the other is what happened in the greatest stretch of literary success that William Shakespeare ever enjoyed. Like, what changed in the year that he wrote King Lear, Macbeth, and Antony and Cleopatra? And the answer is that it was a plague year. The plague was actually Shakespeare's secret weapon. And in this book, I read a lot about how the plague worked to Shakespeare's advantage, and how, like, sometimes opportunity presents itself when we least expect it. Like, you never quite know when the hot hand is going to strike, and sometimes it comes in a plague year. But I also write a lot about Romeo and Juliet, which, you know, I read when I was probably in seventh or eighth grade in an English class, in which I probably didn't actually read it, but, like, you know, was supposed to have read it. And I did not realize that, like, the thing that makes Romeo and Juliet, the thing that makes it go from, like, the most famous love story we have into this terrible tragedy is that someone gets stuck in quarantine. And, like, this book came out, like, literally the day that, like, we started quarantining in the United States. And it was just so uncanny. And, you know, it just sort of, maybe this is like my Kevin Garnett searching for the opal gem. Like, maybe I didn't have the gem, but the timing of it, it just sort of shows, like, how much just, like, random timing and just pure luck factors into our lives.
Right. And also, it contributes to that same kind of poker ethos, which is that when something lines up in that way, even though it is likely just a fluke, if you utilize it to your advantage, you're actually contributing to your hot hand. I mean, so what it sounds like you're saying is that Jeff Bezos is basically modern Shakespeare. In that he figured out how to make a shitload of money off of this pandemic.
Right. Zoom is the new Shakespeare.
Yeah. Shaking my fist. Bezos. I'm like, while I'm watching for the Amazon delivery guy. Well, Ben, gosh, this has been so much fun. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I will tell you that at the end of every episode, I ask my guests the exact same two questions. And they're sort of big picture questions. We've been focusing on sort of a specific topic. So I'm definitely interested to hear what you have to say. You ready for that?
Probably not, but you can go ahead anyway.
Well, I'm doing it anyway. Yeah. All right. So when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you kind of right now, so it could be your work, it could be your personal life, it could be something much more global or cosmic. Number one, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night? The thing that you're most concerned about, maybe even a little bit pessimistic, cynical about? And on the flip side of that, so we end on a more positive note, what are you actually genuinely, kind of authentically excited about, looking forward to, you know, optimistic for?
Well, I think the thing that probably keeps me up at night is just, like, the pure uncertainty of the world that we're living in right now. Like, I think that, like, the world is always uncertain, but to me, it's never just felt more perilously uncertain than it has over the past 6 months. So it's really hard for me to think ahead to, like, next week, let alone, like, January or the following January. Like, I really, for the first time, I think, maybe in my life, like, I feel like I'm more on, like, a day-to-day basis, which is kind of depressing because every day sort of feels like Groundhog Day in a little bit. Like, I no longer take the subway to work. I no longer have colleagues that I see in person. Like, all of the rhythms of my life before March have just been completely disrupted. So that is what
worries me. Right. And, like, next week is not guaranteed, you know,
for sure.
That's the other weird thing. So it's like our rhythms are disrupted. Plus, usually when we look at our calendar, we expect a certain amount of, like, consistency, you know, like, oh, I know what I'm going to be doing next month because I'm going to be doing what I was doing this month. But now it's like, I don't know, will I have a job? I don't know. Will the world be on fire? Like, it's such a tenuous time.
Yeah. People ask me to do things now and they're like, are you free for like an event on January 14th at 7 p.m. And I'm like, I'm almost certainly going to be in exactly the same place that I am right now. And if I'm not, then like something terrible has happened and I'm not free for this event anyway. So that is kind of dispiriting to me. And even something just on like a very small level, like that one thing that I've been really freaked out about for a long time, or not a long time, but like for the last few months is the clock's turning back in October and November, because I'm just like, it's, you know, one of the nice things about this pandemic, if there is such a nice thing, is that it's been really light for most of the day here in New York City. And like, there's going to be a time not too long from now when it's like dark at like 4:30 p.m. and I haven't left, you know, my makeshift desk in my small apartment. And I think that's going to be really psychologically scarring.
I have to admit, when I moved to New York, so I grew up in Texas, born and raised until I was about, I don't know, 23 maybe. And then I moved to New York and I lived in Queens for a year because I was going to Queens College, actually the Graduate Center, but I was located at Queens College in Flushing. So I was living in Forest Hills and it was a really tough transition for a lot of reasons, just culture shock and all that good stuff. But I think one of the hardest things for me was like, I literally had horrific seasonal affective disorder. Right. I couldn't hack it with the dark and the cold. And then ultimately I moved to LA and a lot of those problems were solved for me just from a change of environment. And some people love the energy of New York and there's the grit of New York and, you know, they grew up maybe in New England, so they're more acclimated to it. But for me, it was too dark. I was sad all the time.
So that is something that, that worries me for this winter that is coming up. Right. But I think generally, like what I am optimistic about, I'm optimistic about a lot of things. I think it's like, it probably is smarter to be optimistic than it is pessimistic, but, like within those same confines, like what researching Shakespeare and writing about what he did in the play year did was like fill me with some sort of optimism that like similar developments will happen from what we are going through right now. So whether that is great art or like a change in the way that we think, like the world, you know, will keep evolving and we will have to adapt to it. And I think it's going to be really exciting to see what happens whenever we do go back to whatever normal is. Like it won't be what we are used to, but maybe that's not bad. Like there are plenty of exciting things that can happen from there. And I think the smart thing that we can do is just try to adapt, right? And use that and try to be happy in the world as it exists, even if it's a world that was like unrecognizable not too long ago.
Right. You know, I have to agree. I think sometimes the moodle is needed. Wow. The needle is moved faster or more effectively in traumatic situations, sadly. Like oftentimes we see that resiliency is born of trauma. And so when the entire world is operating in a really dark place, if there were to be a silver lining, it's that there's hopefully, and generally speaking, if we look towards history, progressive movements that come out of that, right? People push a little bit harder or they figure out how to overcome and in doing so, develop specific skills that serve us in the future. And so it's shitty. Nobody wants to have a pandemic to force that, but the truth of the matter is we can't control this. The only thing we can control is our outcome. And yeah, I'm hopeful for that same reason.
On a lighter note, I'm also very excited to watch Steph Curry play basketball again, because there's nothing more thrilling in sports and it's been a very long time. And I have very high hopes for the season 3 of Succession. And I am very excited to see that.
Oh, I'm excited about Succession too. I love that show. You know what I fell off on though was Billions. I'm a little sad about Billions, but I love how Succession's been going.
I wish that, like, you know, I've been writing about the NBA bubble in Disney World for the last few months, and I kind of just wish that, like, Succession had bubbled at the same time, and so that we, like, could have something new to watch on television.
Ugh, so true. There are a lot of good documentaries right now, though, I have to say. That's what I've been surfing a lot lately. Well, Ben, listen, if it gets too dark and too cold and you just can't handle it anymore, come visit us over here on the best coast and enjoy a little bit of sunshine. By then, maybe our skies won't be so full of smoke.
That sounds like an excellent plan.
All right. Well, guys, the book is The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks. Ben, thank you so much for joining me. I learned an awful lot today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.